a congressman who may have stepped in the Blagojevich swamp.
I did not initiate or authorize anyone at any time to promise anything to Governor Blagojevich on my behalf.
Keep hope alive! Keep hope alive! On tomorrow night!
Keeping hope of a political future alive for Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. is suddenly a bit more challenging now that Jackson is candidate number 5 in the complaint against the governor. Will voters buy that he didn't want to buy a Senate seat from Governor Blagojevich? For that other Jackson family, a presumption of dissonance. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 11th, and certainly much more on that scandal unfolding in Illinois.
Yeah. Good morning, Adora.
Also, a lesson on branding for the auto industry and a view of the economy from a small business owner. And lastly, America's briefing book on Latin America. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich says he's back at work in the State House. Many Democrats aren't happy, though. They're offering him a choice. Walk the plank or we'll toss you over.
Given the facts we have today, it will be incumbent upon the governor to leave office, either voluntarily or involuntarily.
That's Illinois State Representative John Fritchie. Legislators plan to impeach the governor if he doesn't step down. President-elect Barack Obama's Senate seat is what we're talking about here. So even though prosecutors say he's done nothing wrong, the scandal's been a distraction for the transition team. Today they're working to change the subject to cabinet appointments once again. Former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle is set to play a key role in the Obama administration's efforts on health care. The president-elect is scheduled to nominate Daschle as health secretary later this morning. And also he's expected to run a new White House Office of Health Reform.
The rest of the talk in Washington is about bailing out automakers. Here's Speaker Nancy Pelosi as a $14 billion loan package cleared the House.
This legislation is about offering Detroit and America to get a chance to get back on track.
Right now, the bailout package is on track for a crash in the Senate with skeptical Republicans like Richard Shelby.
Unless Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors become lean and innovative and competitive in the marketplace, this is only delaying their funeral.
The bill could get a vote in the Senate today.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates brought promises of reinforcements to Afghanistan. 20,000 new troops is the promise. He says he could have most of those in place by the summer. The Dow and the S&P gained 1% yesterday. They begin trading at 899 and 8761, respectively. And what was your first concert? Forget CDs, forget vinyl, forget the 8-track tapes. Live music is what we need.
Mitch from Brooklyn, Billy Joel, 1983, with my mom, brother, and sister. When he played the song Pressure, the crowd went nuts.
And you'll have to deal with pressure.
New York state of mind. But hey, we can top that. We're speaking to a guy today who's been to more than 5,000 concerts. Tell us the story of your favorite at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. What was your favorite?
I was right along with him. My mom was my date. My first concert journey. And my second concert was Prince.
Prince. Second concert was Prince.
Yeah, my mom was my date the first and second time.
Last concert?
The last concert I went to?
Wynton Marsalis.
Why am I drawing a blank? Chris Rock, last New Year's Eve. I consider that a concert.
Oh, yeah.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In just a moment, we're going to talk as the Senate debates the auto bailout rescue package, the daunting task for the U.S. automakers, what to do with their brands, what to do with all those familiar brands and names and looks and logos that they have to deal with going forward as $14 billion may or may not keep them from, as some senators say, the funeral parlor. But we begin with the 2 weeks past the Mumbai terror attacks, which rocked the world and created an escalating spiral of rhetoric between India and Pakistan. We now have some indications that perhaps things are stabilizing. Sanjoy Mamjunder, the BBC India correspondent, joins us from Delhi. Sanjoy, thanks for being a part of the program.
Hello there.
Let's talk about some details that we know about. The Indian government has made its first detailed statement on the Mumbai terror attacks. And we've also had over the last few days an indication from Pakistan that they are seriously cracking down on some suspected terrorists, some suspected Islamic charities that may be linked to the attack. Put this all together, and does it constitute something of a stabilization between India and Pakistan?
Well, I think what you're seeing is while the rhetoric still continues on both sides, there's no immediate mobilization along the border, no indication of any kind of military strike. Now, India, in the immediate aftermath of the Mumbai attacks, had actually said they reserved the right to strike any militant camps located within Pakistan, which may have been linked to the attacks. And it was a stand which was seen here as having been endorsed by the incoming president, Barack Obama, who said every country had the right to defend itself. Well, from that sort of high tension, we've scaled down quite significantly. As you say, Pakistan has targeted the group Lashkar-e-Taiba. It's the militant group that India believes is behind these attacks. They've also been acting against an Islamic charity, the Jamaat-ud-Dawah, which India says is a front for this organization. Well, now the UN Security Council has designated it as a terrorist organization. So we're expecting more from Islamabad.
So what's in the statement that we have today?
Well, today was the first chance really for the government, A, to get back to its own people via parliament and also make its position clear in connection with these latest moves out of Pakistan. And there were really two elements to the statement. One was that they admitted that there were significant intelligence and security lapses which allowed these attacks to take place. They're now saying they're taking steps to ensure that this doesn't happen again. Among the number of measures that were announced today, it includes the setting up of a federal investigating agency, increasing budgets for intelligence services, recruiting more intelligence personnel, even building 20 new counterinsurgency and anti-terror schools to train local policemen to confront such events.
Sanjoy, permit me to interrupt you just for a second. There are two sort of targets of consumption of this statement. One is the international community, which wants a stabilization between India and Pakistan, and that sounds pretty positive. But what about for domestic consumption? This is a government trying to save itself, right?
Yes, this is a government that's trying to save itself. I think it's feeling slightly more relieved because in the past 5 days, they've had some decent election results. We've had local, provincial, state-level elections here in India, which everyone had expected to go against the government because those states voted in the immediate aftermath of the attacks. Well, that didn't happen. The incumbent government actually won a majority of those states. And I think that's made them feel that perhaps the voter backlash isn't as significant as they thought.
Taking
the pressure off a bit.
Yeah, good. Sanjoy, what about the likelihood that India will take these moves on the part of Pakistan seriously as a good faith measure or even a substantive measure to control terrorism inside Pakistan's borders?
Well, the first indication we've had so far is they're still quite hard on Pakistan. We've had the foreign minister speak today in parliament. He basically said that while they've seen some action on the ground, really they would have to see where these actions lead. In particular, they said that they have asked for some of those suspects to be handed over to India. That's not happened just as yet. At the same time, he said there's absolutely no question of mobilizing for war. There is, India was not going to be provoked into doing anything aggressive where Pakistan.
A cautious response, but no escalation of rhetoric. That's pretty interesting, positive stuff. Sanjoy Mamjunder, thanks for joining us. He's the BBC India correspondent, and he joined us from Delhi.
Now we're going to talk about the auto industry.
They say that pain is merely your body's way of getting rid of weakness.
Silverado, it's the right truck from Chevy. The most dependable, longest-lasting trucks on the road.
From tough to crumbling, the big three automakers are awaiting a verdict from lawmakers on a bailout bill on Capitol Hill. It begs the question, what happened to the brand of the American auto industry, the American car? Joining us now is Elizabeth Tellerman, an award-winning brand strategist and author of the blog Brand Immersion, for a few thoughts on this. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Adora.
So clearly the numbers are stunning. In November, I think car sales were down something like 40%. But you argue in some sense that it's not so much about American automakers making inferior cars, but the sense that they are inferior cars.
You know, the American automakers got caught with their pants down in the 70s, and they were making terrible cars. The Japanese came in and swept our industry, this industry of innovation. Now, in the intervening years, we've actually made some pretty big improvements, and we've closed that quality gap. The issue is that our brands never led with behavior. You've got Ford out there years ago using quality as job one, but Toyota's leading with quality and delivering quality every day. You lose a lot of authenticity with the consumer. They're smart.
What brands in the 70s sort of went away, got so tainted that they're almost a joke now?
You know, some of those brands still exist. And if I ask you guys the question, you know, what are the brands under Chrysler? Can you tell me what they are? Do they come to mind?
Well, Dodge. Dodge, of course, which is a mark. It's not really a brand, but you got the Dodge Ram trucks, which seems like a fairly solid brand. Yeah. Chrysler Sebring, but again,
and you've got things like Pacifica and Crossfire. These aren't dropping off the tip of my tongue. Part of the issue, too, is that the American automakers have a proliferation of brands. There are almost too many of them. And when we look at the recent events, recent announcements from GM, they're cutting back from, you know, dedication to 8 brands and cutting down to 4. I'd argue that they could cut down to 3, Chevy, Cadillac, and Buick.
And Oldsmobile doesn't even exist anymore.
Gone away.
So is it too late, other than cutting down to brands? I mean, you have some concrete suggestions on how they recreate the sense of strength.
Yeah, absolutely. Number one is product. There is nothing that will kill a great brand faster than a bad product. So product innovation is key. How, again, the American automakers could get caught with their pants down and allow Toyota to walk in the door a few years ago with the Prius, anticipating customer need, it's beyond me, especially when in 1996, we had the EV1.
Right.
We had a phenomenal
product. Right.
So what are the things they can do? The first is know themselves. Nike, 3 words, authentic athletic performance. Everything they do, everything they put out into the world has to meet that acid test.
But even interestingly enough, before you get to the specifics, I mean, you say they need to start by cutting the heads off of all the CEOs and just starting there.
You know, I can't imagine a CEO keeping their job if not only their company doesn't perform, their brands don't perform, and they get in such a financial hole that they got to put their hand out. Why, with a lack of performance that's that dramatic, why keep them?
Alan Mulally was on Capitol Hill, I remember, saying, you know, what we used to do was focus on trucks and SUVs. You know, but what he didn't say was used to was last year. Used to was like 5 months ago. Now he's going to do fuel-efficient cars from Europe, but it's probably too late for that.
Yeah, where was the anticipation of customer need? And hello, let's just open our eyes. If you can't anticipate customer need, look at your competition. They were doing it a few years ago. So all of a sudden, it's big news now. All of a sudden, it's great big news that the Volt is going to come out in 2010. You got to laugh.
So they got to start with the product.
They
got to have a credible team leading that inspires confidence in the consumer.
Absolutely. And you got to lead with behavior, not rhetoric. Taglines aren't going to fix the problem, and consumers are too smart for that. You've got to anticipate customer needs, and you've got to design for customer desire. The world didn't need a 4-inch, $400 MP3 player, and no focus group was going to tell us that the world needed that. But innovation and design led Apple to launch an iPod, which was bigger and more expensive. Doesn't make sense from a focus group point of view, but when you really know your customer, you anticipate their need, you know how to design for them.
That's Elizabeth Tellerman, an award-winning brand strategist and author of the blog Brand Immersion, and she's going to stick with us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We are a growing company, and we're doing well. And even in this economic climate, we're hunkering down, and we're going to get through this.
That's Jim Svet, the then CEO of Muddy Cup Coffee House franchises in upstate New York, and he was talking back in late September. The elections have come and gone, bailouts have begun, and the economy continues to struggle. How is this small businessman doing today? Jim Svet is on the line from Beacon, New York. Welcome back, Jim.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Are you still CEO?
Well, we're not really sure yet, but apparently I'm not. Things really changed after the last time I was on the show in October. After 8 years of building this company, we took on an investor in New York who helped us finance some growth, Jerry Schwartz from Pergolis & Schwartz. And in October, he called me and said his mortgage company was not doing very well and that he needed to cut back. And I guess cutting back meant getting rid of me. So we don't know what's going to happen now at this point, so I guess I'm now a victim of the economy at this point.
What about the Muddy Cup coffee houses? Are they still open? How many of them are open? Have you laid off employees?
Well, 3 months ago, we opened our ninth store in Saugerties, New York. And now, since I've sort of been pushed to the side, they've closed the Poughkeepsie store. And they've cut hours back at most of the stores and laid off some people, so I don't know what's going to happen, but it's a struggle.
You founded the company 8 years ago. What's going through your head about now?
Oh, it kind of mixed emotions. You know, I feel very passionate about the company that I built and the employees and especially the customers. And I had people calling me every hour of the day. But at the same time, you think, well, it's been 8 years. Is it time to move on? Is it time to do something different? So, you know, all those questions kind of go through your head.
Jim, do you think you're a victim of the same kind of problems that Starbucks is having because of your product? Or is it more, it sounds like you got caught in the credit crunch as well because your financing really sort of went away?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both for us, obviously. I mean, even in my neighborhoods, you know, I'm in 9 different neighborhoods in upstate New York, and I see restaurants and cafes, just like Starbucks, are all struggling up here now, even more than last time I talked to you. And I'm a victim of the credit crunch as well. Yes, absolutely.
Jim, I'm going to invite Elizabeth Tellerman back into our conversation. She's a brand strategist. And Elizabeth, you're over here nodding your head. The story's similar. I mean, sounds familiar, rather.
The story does sound familiar, and it's heartbreaking because it sounds like this is a brand that consumers love. And there's no parting with that. That's one of the most important things you can do for a brand is create that kind of consumer love.
Well, Jim, let's talk about this brand because maybe there's a tweak here and Elizabeth can help you with it. I mean, I'm suspecting that for all of the local folksiness of Muddy Cup, you have a certain aspect of we're value added, we're higher quality, we're maybe a little more expensive than your Maxwell House coffee. And I'm wondering if you have to adjust that in these times. And Elizabeth, I suspect you have some advice there.
Sure. I think that you got to take that customer love and turn it into a movement, right? And you've got to serve them back for that love. So it starts with, if they're hurting, what are you going to do for them to acknowledge the recession, to invite them in, but to keep your business stable? If we forgot about the credit crunch part of your business, it sounds like you were pretty healthy and you had people coming in. You're not Starbucks. You're not a big machine, so you can be much more agile. It's Tuesday's the day, just like the gas companies, where you get 10 cents off your cup of coffee. What do you do on Sundays to invite people in and create that family environment? When they love you, they want you to succeed, and they're standing there waiting for you. You might even be able to use that to leverage your way right back into being CEO if you're not done yet.
Right, and you know, we've always been, our price point has always been lower than all our competitors. We're a larger space. We're much more comfortable in a much richer environment than any of our competitors. And we've always had that really great brand loyalty in Hudson Valley. We're the most recognized shop in some of these towns. But part of that has always been me, too. I've been part of that brand. And now that I've been pushed aside, all the prices got raised. So I think it's now we're going in the wrong direction from what I think we should be. And your advice is right on.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, this one's tough. You got to gain control. You got to force your way back in there. Or you got to get your customers to do it for you because you know they can't afford raised prices, and you know that's the end of your brand once you start to betray their confidence.
Jim, do you own Muddy Cup? Do you own the intellectual property of Muddy Cup itself?
Well, it's owned by the corporation, which Mr. Schwartz and I are partners now. So it's you know, it's a bit of a legal issue, too, I guess, that I'm going to have to deal with.
Go fight for that business, Jim. It sounds like you've still got some breath and some life in that. I think you got to fight for what you built. It's not over yet.
Right. And the customers and the employees are helping me to do that. And I agree. Absolutely.
Well, Jim Svetz, we wish you all the best, and we thank you for joining us at this difficult time.
Yeah, well, I wish everybody luck, and good luck to all small business owners out there.
Jim Svetz, former CEO or current CEO of Muddy Cup Coffee House's franchises in upstate New York, and Elizabeth Tellerman, an award-winning brand strategist and author of the blog Brand Immersion. Thank you both. Now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got the latest headlines.
Thank you very much. Belgian police have arrested 14 people they think are linked with Al-Qaeda. Prosecutors say one of them might have been planning a suicide attack. The suspects had recently traveled to Pakistan and Afghanistan. Relatives of 9/11 victims say they don't like what's going on at the Guantanamo Bay military trials. The group of relatives say that the military trials are unfair, and they say this in a letter that's released by the American Civil Liberties Union. Five men are on trial there now, including a man prosecutors say is the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. Former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle is set to play a key role in the Obama administration's efforts to improve health care. Today, the president-elect is scheduled to nominate Daschle as Secretary of Health and Human Services, and Daschle is also expected to run a new White House Office of Health Reform. A UN panel says that both Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo are secretly backing rival militias in eastern Congo. Fierce fighting there has driven more than a quarter of a million people from their homes, and Rwanda is said to be backing a renegade general's fight against the Congolese government. And look out for this morning for the nominations for the Golden Globes. They will be announced at the Beverly Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles for Best Picture. This is what people are saying. This is the buzz around Milk, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, The Dark Knight and Slumdog Millionaire, and also Wally as well. Adore, John, did you know The Dark Knight is going to be re-released in January? Just to
kind of it's already available. It's already downloadable.
At movies, though, coming back into the movie houses in January.
Yeah, 3D or something?
No, just coming back so people
can
see it.
They're just re-releasing it.
So maybe the Academy can see it again in the medium it was meant to be shown in.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Let's look at your news for now.
Thanks,
I'll be back.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. This morning, we're asking you to take a trip down memory lane. Think about your very first concert. Oh, the memories. We're asking today, what was your first concert? Who did you go to see? What was it like? And have your tastes changed a bit? I still like Prince.
You went to Prince?
No, I did, yes. And it was a great, he's an extraordinary performer. Oh, yeah. It was fantastic.
Did you take a date? Did you take a date?
Yeah, my mom. It was my mom, Mary Udoji, and me. Anyhow, we want to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
First concerts, and do you like live music better than recorded music? Certainly the revolution in the recording industry has made a counter-revolution in live performance. Ray Morrissey there in London, what was the price of a ticket at your very first concert, I guess, 35 years ago?
Well, yeah, the first prices were like 75p and £1, which is, what's that, a dollar and a half maybe?
So your first concert was what, Ray?
£1 and the bands were Mott the Hoople. Supported by an unknown band called Queen.
Oh, my God.
Whatever happened to them?
And you saw that for a dollar and a half?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, 1973.
Man, well, let me tell you a little bit about Ray Morrissey, our guest. He's a rock fan, but in fact, he's Britain's most prolific, as far as we know, concert goer. In 35 years, Ray Morrissey has been to more than how many gigs?
5,105.
5,105. Oh, wow. And every single one of them, the critique, the review, whatever you want to call it, is in a series of little notebooks, which are now on his website. What's your website, Ray?
That's it, raysgigs.com.
Raysgigs.com. And every single one of them. Now, why did you start doing this? And 5,000 gigs, that's an enormous archive of recorded music history.
Well, it's strange, really. When I was just sort of a 14-year-old in 1973... I just kind of kept notes on stuff, and I always kept a diary, which helped. And then when I thought about this website, I thought, well, the information's there. It just takes a bit of a while to get up there because it's 100,000 words now.
So when you saw Freddie Mercury back in 1973 at this Mott the Hoople concert where Queen opened.
That's right.
I mean, did you think he was going to be as huge as he turned out to be?
Well, not really, because as a 14-year-old, he had quite a scary face to me because he had that kind of big mouth and teeth. And I always thought, you know, you can't be a big successful rock star with a sort of, you know, that kind of face, really.
Well, I suspect, Ray, that one of the stories in your 5,150 or so reviews of all the concerts you've seen is this narrative of things that you thought were going to be great that turned out not to be, and things that you had no idea would be big that turned out to be huge. What was something you predicted was going to be the next big thing that never made it?
God, oh, there's loads of little bands like that. Bands like The Godfathers. Do you remember The Alarm?
Nope.
In the 80s?
Nope.
Right, well, you know, they were kind of like the Welsh U2, really. And they came out at the same time as U2, and you would have thought they'd be as big as U2 now, but they're not, you know.
Now, there were some musicians in your school that started a band. Tell this story.
Well, yeah, this is when I was a youngster, a couple of guys were 3 years older, and they had formed a band, and they were playing down the West End. So we thought, well, if they're good enough to play down the West End, that was a big deal, you know. In the center of town, and they were called the Sex Pistols.
They did, all right.
You know, before punk rock even kicked off, we thought, well, we've got to go and check them out, you know. And true enough, it was the Sex Pistols that we, but at the time, you know, you didn't know that they were going to be massive, you know, no way.
And Ray, you actually have a top 10 list, the top 10 live bands. You have Sex Pistols number one, and number 10 is Van Halen. You want to tell us about who's in between and what makes them so great in concert?
Well, they've got the combination, really, as a live concert goer. You know, they've got the one, they've got to have good songs anyway, and two, they're great show people. You know, they put on a, you know, there's plenty of energy jumping around. I mean, my favorite, you know, American band, The Kiss, you know, you either love them or hate them, you know, it seems with Kiss. But, you know, Kiss put on this full show, loads of great songs from the 70s.
A lot of rock and a lot of metal here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know, AC/DC as well, you know, that's going to be a highlight. I think they're in America now, but they're in Europe next year, so that's another highlight.
What year was your first rave, Ray, or your first sort of trip to the mosh pit?
To the mosh pit? Well, punk rock stuff, yeah. I mean, with prog rock, there wasn't really much jumping around, but when... punk rock kicked off in 76 and 77. Every show was down the front, getting sweaty, falling on the floor, getting picked up. and having a, you know, wringing the sweat out of your T-shirt at the end of the night.
Man, well, we can't go without you describing what it was like to be at Wembley in 1985 at that Live Aid concert, where by that time Freddie Mercury was huge.
That's
and
right, yeah,
he was just one of many.
Well, that was the sort of probably the greatest live day of music ever, really. You know, that was the first big kind of charity show. They had everybody. There was, you know, there was half a dozen bands that could play Wembley on their own. There, Paul McCartney, U2, Queen, and you know, Queen kind of stole the show a bit, you know. But it's like 11 hours of the best music out there, you know.
Well, Ray, how high do you think you can go? You're over 5,000 now.
Right. Well, that was kind of an ambition. I'm 50 years old next year,
and
it's getting harder as you're getting older. It does get harder, but a lot of it, if you live in the right area, you know, like New York, you know. You know, if you've got quality music around you, you've got a tendency to go out more, you know. And I live in London, and, you know, everybody comes through London, really.
Ray, do you work in the music business?
No, that's it. No, I used to, in the 80s, I had a job at Hammersmith Odeon on security, front stage security.
Love it.
So that was quite good, because I'd get paid for seeing the bands then.
What's your website again, Ray?
RaysGigs.com, RaysGigs, all as one word, .com.
Oh. Ray Morrissey, the most prolific gigger in London and perhaps the most prolific concert goer of all time. I certainly can't compete with him, even though I do have ticket stubs from the Yes concert where they played this tune Roundabout. Ray Morrissey joined us from Bush House, London, and his website contains thousands of reviews of concerts he's been to. Femi Okeh, take us out.
I love this piece of music.
It gets much worse.
Oh, okay. Oh, then 20 minutes to the top of the hour, if it's getting worse. I do have some news for you as well. Good morning, all. New jobless claims jump more than expected to 573,000. That's the highest level in 26 years. Pakistan has closed the offices of a charity that American intelligence believes is a front for the terror group accused of tie to the Mumbai attacks. And this comes a day after the United Nations declared the group a terrorist organization. The US wants to do more to fight piracy off the coast of Somalia. They are pushing the United Nations to let governments pursue pirates on Somali land. And there have been more than 100 attacks off the coast so far this year. And Somalia would have to give permission for military operations on their soil. And finally, a retail icon in the UK is very close to shutting down. Woolworths is the latest casualty of the struggling economy, and stores across the UK are holding close-out sales today. And bargain-hunting shoppers are very sad to see the store close down. It may, just may, find a buyer before the end of the year to keep the Woolworths name going in the UK.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji, and it's The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and it's not official yet, and it may not even be confirmed, but that a Nobel Prize winner is even being considered for Energy Secretary marks a break from the past. Certainly the Bush administration's reputation for politicized science appointments is well known and perhaps will not be continuing into this administration. Joining us to discuss the possible nomination of Stephen Chu as Energy Secretary, he's a Nobel laureate and runs the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, is Matt Wald of the New York Times here. Matt, thanks for joining us. And do you think that Stephen Chu's consideration marks some sort of hint of the new administration's approach to science?
Good morning, John. I think it might and it might not. I think more than him being a scientist is his focus on global warming. Our current energy secretary began as a scientist. We've had a lot of smart people in that job, but they've been pulled in a lot of different directions. Dr. Chu's focused in very sharply on global warming and alternative energy for years now.
And so he has operational experience in grappling with some of these issues, both on the scientific level.
He never ran an energy company, right, but he did run a lab, so he has some management experience also. I should say, though, that traditionally the Department of Energy is really the Department of Nuclear Weapons Production, and more recently the Department of Nuclear Weapons Production Cleanup, with a little bit of energy tacked on the end. Well, the big shift in direction might be actually turning it to energy.
Let's describe that, though, because during the 1980s, I believe, the U.S. government put the production laboratories and facilities for nuclear weapons under control of the Energy Department, and then also the disposal went under the Energy Department. What of the Energy Department is actual research and development and might address issues like fossil fuels?
Well, they've got a number of labs that work in this area, but if you look at where the bulk of the money went, first it went to making plutonium and tritium for weapons and refurbishing weapons and developing new weapons, and then it went to cleaning up the mess they made making plutonium and tritium for weapons and refurbishing weapons, etc. We have always had laboratories that work on solar power, that work on wind, that keep track of oil production and do a little work on how to produce more oil, what to do with coal, et cetera. But it has, on a money basis, never been the main focus.
Well, what is the chance that Stephen Chu might be a part of a Barack Obama nuclear energy approach to dealing with carbon emissions, fossil fuels, et cetera?
The federal government is on a pretty strong track towards encouraging new nuclear reactors. We haven't ordered one in this country that didn't later get canceled since 1974, so it's been a long time. I think that those are likely to get built if the credit crunch isn't too bad,
mm-hmm.
but I think also it's going to take a lot more than, say, 8 or 10 or 20 nuclear reactors to turn around this country's carbon dioxide
right.
output.
Before we go, any hint of some exotic technological interests on the part of Dr. Chu before we go, quickly?
He got his Nobel for trapping individual atoms in laser light and then examining them. It uses a lot of energy. It's not energy production, but he has a very broad view of wind, sun, conservation, etc., and he does have a scientist's view of the whole ball of wax.
Do atoms like it when they get trapped inside laser beams like that, or does that annoy them?
There's no Society for the Protection of the Rights of Atoms, and they did tell us interesting things under this form of water torture.
Interesting. Matt Wald, the New York Times writer on the possible nomination of Dr. Stephen Chu as Energy Secretary. He directs the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and has a Nobel Prize in Physics. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, John.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 11th, and let's get caught up on the headlines. Here's Femi Oke.
Hello there. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The $14 billion auto industry bailout is one step closer to becoming reality. Congressman Jose Serrano announced the results of the House vote.
The yeas are 237, the nays are 170, one voting present. The bill is passed.
And the bill could go for a vote in the Senate today, where it faces skeptical Republicans. GM and Chrysler would get loans right away, and Ford could get the money as well, but it says it's okay for now. Oil prices rose as the auto bailout moved forward. Prices topped $45 a barrel. Former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle is set to play a key role in the Obama administration's efforts to improve health care. Today, the president-elect is scheduled to nominate Daschle as secretary.
To dominate Daschle?
That's a whole
that's
different scenario.
It's kind of freaky.
And you didn't miss a beat to jump
no.
in on that, did you?
No.
There will be no dominating of Daschle, but there will be some nominating of Daschle as secretary of health and human services. Daschle is also expected to run a new White House Office of Health Reform. More U.S. troops are going to Afghanistan. The Pentagon is working to bring thousands more soldiers in by the summer. And Defense Secretary Robert Gates says he won't have to cut troops in Iraq to do it. Gates is in Afghanistan today. And finally, India is launching a massive overhaul of its security and intelligence agencies today in the wake of the Mumbai attacks. The government wants to beef up anti-terrorism laws and create a national law enforcement arm, which will be modelled on the FBI. And that's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. Can we go back to the briefing book for President-elect Barack Obama now? There's plenty to talk about in the notion of a Latin American policy for the new president. Both the economic situation and the diplomatic situation are in transition there. And joining us to talk about what the transition needs to be paying attention to there is Jorge Castañeda. He's a former foreign minister of Mexico and global distinguished professor of politics and Latin American studies at NYU, and he's here in our studio. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
There's a lot to get to. Let me just try to break it down into three categories. We've got the region, the hemisphere itself. You've got the Castro situation, which is likely to change, could conceivably change in the next decade. And then I think we'll end on the situation in Mexico, which has certainly transformed radically over the last, even 18 months or so. Well, let's begin with the region. How should the U.S. Face Latin America most broadly in this economic environment?
Well, I think the first thing is that President Obama, once he does take office and is no longer president-elect, should make a point of showing that he is interested, that he's involved, he's engaged in Latin America. He will have an opportunity to do so at the so-called Summit of the Americas, which will take place in Trinidad and Tobago in April. That will be his first chance to meet all of the Latin American leaders in one trip. It's important that he be there, that he listen, instead of necessarily going to talk, just to listen, which would be very well received by Latin American leaders who are more accustomed to a different way of proceeding, of being told what the United States thinks they should do.
So are they all going to ask him, so were you really serious about that stuff you said about NAFTA, or was it more like what your former campaign aide said, that you actually weren't serious about changing the trade relationship?
Well, I'm sure that's one of the questions leaders from Mexico, from Colombia, from Central America, the countries that have free trade agreements already approved with the U.S. or that are pending, like Colombia, will ask. Certainly, they'll also ask whether there will continue to be the type of support that has been present the last few months from the Bush administration, from the Fed, for countries like Brazil and Mexico that would have huge credit lines open to them, $30 billion each. And I think they will also want to know if he would like to change the U.S. image in Latin America. Most countries, most leaders in Latin America prefer to have friendly relations with the U.S. than not. Not everybody, but most people do.
So when you say change the image, what is currently the image?
It's terrible, and the reason for the terrible image is one single word. You need nothing more. Iraq. Mm. It's called Iraq.
That trumps all of the other very difficult issues that all of these countries are facing, whether you're talking about economics or the drug trade.
Absolutely, because most Latin American countries are used to dealing with the United States on drugs, on trade, on finance, on immigration, on all of these issues. What they were not used to is having an American president like George Bush, as unpopular as he is in Latin America. And it's very difficult to deal with the U.S. So it's Iraq. I mean, what do the peasants in Bolivia care about the U.S. invasion of Iraq? And you're right, but the fact is they do.
Yet on some level, Iraq is an abstraction in this hemisphere when you have enormous capital fall-offs, losses in the stock market in Argentina, in Brazil, in Mexico have been huge, and all of that relates to the economic downturn in the United States. And I'm just wondering if there's some motive to maybe get beyond Iraq, as we apparently have in the United States, and to move again to these economic realities.
Well, I think most of the leaders in Latin America would want to, and to put all of these other issues at the center of the agenda with the United States. The problem is, if you're dealing with a government of the United States that is so unpopular that you have demonstrations in the streets, you have people, you know, trying to burn down the embassies, you have this sort of generally negative atmospherics, it is very difficult to set aside the rhetoric and set aside Iraq, et cetera, unilateralism, and move on to the important issues. Obama can change this practically overnight, even if he doesn't withdraw from Iraq overnight. But by saying that he will soon and having a timetable and stressing this point, I think he will have a marvelous reception in Latin America when he finally decides.
So at the very least, he has an enormous opportunity. How important to the region is the Obama initial gestures to Cuba and the Castro regime?
Well, I think they're more important for some countries than for others. Obviously, there are countries like Venezuela, like Bolivia, Ecuador, perhaps Nicaragua, who for ideological reasons want that to change. I'm not sure how sincere they are in the sense that, you know, I know they love to say they would like the United States to lift the embargo. I'm not sure that they really want the United States to lift the embargo. In the same way, I'm not sure Fidel Castro or Raul Castro want the United States to lift the embargo. The Castro brothers and Fidel in particular, the last 50 years, it's going to be 50 years in a few weeks, have had a habit of systematically shooting down any possibility of the embargo actually being lifted, going back to the Carter administration and obviously with Clinton. So, but for some countries, it's ideologically important. For others, it really is not a big deal. It would be a gesture. I think it would be very useful for Obama to lift the embargo unilaterally. But once he does that, then engage in negotiations with the Cubans where issues like democracy and human rights are not set aside. They should not be a precondition for lifting the embargo, but they should be a condition for normalization.
I guess I'm struck by the fact of where Mexico is today and where Mexico is today in relationship to the United States compared to the great hopes when George Bush initially came into office on issues of immigration and trade relations.
Well, the central issue for Mexico in relationship with the United States is immigration. In that sense, Mexico is not unique in Latin America, but it's different along with a few other countries, Ecuador, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, perhaps the Caribbean. Immigration really is the most important issue. And Bush dropped the ball. He promised a lot. At the end, he tried to deliver, but when he tried, he was too weak to be able to deliver. Will Obama try to get some immigration reform done, or will he at least suspend the hateful raids, detentions, deportations, no-match letters, etc., that Homeland Security has been carrying out all over the United States, even in New York, a sort of atmosphere that has led to the incidents in Suffolk County, et cetera. Will he do this? He can do this on January 20th in the evening if he wants to. He doesn't need Congress. He doesn't need anything. He can do this right away. I hope he does, and then move in the direction of immigration reform.
Well, out of time, Jorge, and we didn't even talk about Hugo Chavez, but there may be more less than meets the eye there. We should talk to you again soon about that. Jorge Castañeda is a former foreign minister of Mexico and global distinguished professor of politics and Latin American studies at NYU.
But he certainly did get to a lot of points and a lot of interesting insights there. We're always on here at The Takeaway, and today we're talking about concerts.
First concert I could remember was in the mid-60s, The Doors. And as to whether or not my tastes have changed, now Hello, I Love You, which I think came later, is now the answering tone on my cell phone.
Hello, I love you, won't you tell me your name? Hello.
So some things never change, Sean. We want to hear your story about going to concerts, your first concert, your favorite concert. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
And here's your takeaway.
There is nothing that will kill a great brand faster than a bad product.
That's Elizabeth Tellerman, an award-winning brand strategist and author of the blog Brand Immersion.
What else could kill a brand, though?
Oh, a lot of things. Rumors, urban legends.
Well, you know, the Tylenol brand is an interesting case there. There was a poisoning scandal that actually killed people, but they preserved their brand by bouncing back. So it's actually one of the amazing brand stories of all time.
Right, and I think Elizabeth makes a point about Tide. It's been around forever, and they
Tide?
Keep expanding Tide, the detergent. It's been around forever, but they keep expanding their market share.
And brought to you by Tide. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Good morning, Charlie George in eastern China. Good evening.
Good evening.
What's the name of the town you're in?
Yantai.
So I've got some alarming news for you, Charlie.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Your adventure, teaching, and working. I guess you're a business and English teacher there in China. It may not be working out.
What do you mean?
We got this email from your wife, Kathy, the other day, and she actually referred you as a candidate for a job we know about back here in the States.
Well, that's possible.
Well, she sounded a little desperate, Charlie. And the job she mentioned is a really awful job. I mean, she nominated you to be this new car czar.
Car czar.
Overseeing the bailout of the struggling U.S. auto industry.
Oh, man.
Have you done any czar work in the past, Charlie?
Well, you know, the permitting business, you're kind of czar. Nothing happens, no development, unless you say yes.
$14 billion. Can you manage a budget like that?
Yeah. In public works, you know, after the first million, it's just money.
All right. Well, dealing with stubborn, possibly overpaid corporate executives, could you manage that?
Well, it's a pain, but you can do it.
All right. Well, one more thing. You would have to relocate to Washington, D.C., Charlie.
Man, you know, the housing prices I hear are really cheap in Detroit. Wouldn't it be better if we located there?
No, it's got to be D.C. Deal breaker?
Deal breaker.
Ouch. We almost had a czar there. We're going to have to make do with The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 11th. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Got to love our listeners, Adora.
Oh, we do. We do. I don't think he's too excited, though, about moving to D.C., but
Not going to happen.
Maybe there's another job there for him in Detroit. Today, the latest on the political scandal in Illinois, cheap fares on the airlines, or at least cheap fares for flights on planes. It's true. And saving the world from people. We talked to someone who has a few ideas. Those stories coming up, but first, we have some headlines.
Some more bad economic news just out this hour. The weekly jobless claims number spiked to 573,000. It's worse than expected and the highest in 26 years. Big part of the backers' case for the $14 billion auto bailout is that car company failures could drive those numbers even higher. The loan package has passed the House but faces some stiff Republican opposition in the Senate from Republican Senator David Vitter.
My big concern is that it doesn't demand and accomplish the really fundamental restructuring of these companies that it's going to take for them to survive.
But the survival is a question for the U.S. economy if a bill isn't passed. Here's Democratic Congressman John Dingell.
This is a bridge loan. Without this bridge, we're going to fall into the deepest calamity this country has seen since the Great Depression.
More hyperbole expected later today when the Senate votes.
Former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle is set to play a key role in the Obama administration's health care efforts. The president-elect is scheduled to nominate Daschle as health secretary later this morning. Daschle is also expected to run a new White House office on health reform. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is at work in the State House today. His office says today is, quote, business as usual. Now, that presumes business as usual includes ignoring calls for his resignation from President-elect Obama and scores of Democrats.
Boy, there's a question. What constitutes business as usual for Governor Blagojevich? We're talking about concert tickets today.
In 1958, I went to see a concert in Brooklyn with the Big Bopper, Richie Valens, and Buddy Holly.
Oh, man.
Shortly before they were killed.
Hello, baby. Yeah, this is the Big Bopper.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, as tragic and entertaining as the allegations surrounding Governor Rod Blagojevich of Illinois are, it's a constitutional, full-fledged constitutional crisis in the state of Illinois this morning. As the Illinois legislators try to figure out what to do next, there's a Senate appointment at stake. Also, who's going to be governor of this state? Joining us to talk about all of it is Amanda Vinicky, who's the State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio. Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
Can we begin with the news conference that Jesse Jackson Jr. gave yesterday, indicating that he wanted to make no deal for the Senate seat? But apparently the news conference was in response to him appearing in some capacity in the body of evidence that Patrick Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney, revealed this week.
Yes, in that affidavit, there is a lot of talk about Senate Candidate 5, who, in the selling off that Rod Blagojevich was allegedly doing of Barack Obama's vacated Senate seat, going to the highest bidder. It appears as if that Senate Candidate 5 was the highest bidder, offering up perhaps $1 million, some money up front and then some for a future Blagojevich campaign down the line, were he to get that Senate seat. In the affidavit, you never hear from Senate Candidate 5 himself. It's just Governor Blagojevich talking about an emissary of said candidate and offering up this money. So Jesse Jackson Jr., the congressman, has come out and said, yes, that's me. His attorney came out and identified Senate Candidate 5 as Jesse Jackson Jr., but he says, no, I did no wrong.
Well, let's talk about the implications of that in the very unique, as we learn once again, state of Illinois and Illinois politics. I mean, the chain of proof required to link the congressman to that kind of deal making is a pretty high bar. Yet, it's also kind of radioactive in the sense that there's a low bar to tainting Congressman Jackson so that he's sort of irrevocably stung with this whole mess. Which is it, do you think?
You know, I think it's very much this taint right now. Anybody who has a relationship with Governor Blagojevich right now is, as you said, radioactive. You don't want that. And whereas whereas Congressman Jackson's attorney had also said, you know, if the governor were to offer this seat to Congressman Jackson, I would advise him to take it. I think that would be damaging beyond belief right now. There's nobody that would want that seat, let alone Congressman Jackson, who clearly would want it not just for the 2 years remaining in the term, but to run again to take it. Because how would you ever get past this after these accusations have been made about Governor Blagojevich?
Any other suspected candidates? I mean, you know, he's number five, so that means there's 4, 3, 2, and 1.
You know, in the complaint, he is the one that's most notably making deals. There's reference to Senate Candidate 1, who is believed to be Valerie Jarrett, an Obama confidant. But again, Obama supposedly had no knowledge of what was going on, and they were not willing to make deals. And in fact, Jarrett took herself out of the running. So you have these other candidates, but really Senate Candidate 5 is the one that is brought into the pay-to-play sort of politics that are being admonished here.
All right. So before we go then, the Illinois legislature has the option of essentially kind of making up a whole new scenario for selecting this Senate seat, and it looks like it's the consensus is rallying around a special election. Any idea how the details of that are going to be managed?
You know, I have not seen the legislation yet, but that will probably come on Monday. The House is going to start that legislation in the committee on Monday, and the Senate's going to be in as well. And the plan, as you said, is to have a special election. We'll see how that will go forward. I think that came out as kind of a let the people decide, this populist move in the face of these horrible political allegations, especially, you know, about a Democratic governor in a state where Democrats control everything. However, you have a lot of people that point to problems with any special election. You have some Democrats that are frightened that in a Blagojevich backlash, a Republican would be elected to the seat, and so that Democrats would lose it. There's also, it could cost $50 million by a State Board of Elections officials' projections and take a lot of time. So that's the idea, and that's what's being thrown out. Whether it will pass or go forward, I don't know yet.
And a lot of that depends, of course, Amanda, on whether or not the governor just decides to step down, because if he did that, then it would become abundantly clear. A new governor would step up, the lieutenant governor would become governor, and he would appoint someone to Obama's Senate seat.
Exactly. And at this point, who knows what the governor will do? In my couple of years here covering him, I have learned to never make predictions because it is impossible to read what Governor Blagojevich will do. At this point, he's steadfastly maintained he's not going to resign. But, you know, he would be the first Illinois governor in history ever impeached. So that might be an incentive.
Amanda, you know, at the risk of being accused of being a sort of a sordid voyeur of Illinois politics, it's got to be a fascinating week to be wandering the halls of Springfield and talking to downstaters about what's been going on in this Blagojevich scandal. I mean, this is going to be one of those stories where were you when the Blagojevich arrest took place? Am I right?
You are exactly right. And in fact, I've already had that conversation with many of my friends. I think that especially the case here and why this is, I mean, obviously it would be a huge deal no matter what, but even more so than usual because Governor Blagojevich is really fairly disliked, especially in state house circles. And I'm based in the Capitol. And Democrats, as well as Republicans, have a horrible relationship with him. He has very few friends left. The few that he did have that were very close with him, he has kind of sold out a few, I would guess, and I would say, and not necessarily been known as loyal. He has been known to break a lot of deals. Now, in order for a budget measure to get passed, you'll have to that relies on the governor. Lawmakers will have him sign a memorandum of understanding because the trust has been so breached, and that's been going on for years. So it was a holiday.
He may have the opportunity to pursue his popularity depending on how things turn out in the prison there in Illinois. Amanda Vinicky, thanks so much for joining us. Amanda is the State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio. She's based in Springfield, Illinois, where she joined us from.
Now we're going to move on to the Democratic Republic of Congo. A new report from the United Nations accuses both Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo of supporting opposing rebel movements fighting inside Congo, and that's country's conflict that has displaced over 250,000 people. We go straight to Thomas Fessy, the BBC's correspondent in Kinshasa. Welcome back, Thomas. What's happening with this UN report?
Hi. Well, basically, the draft report that I've seen is quite strong in making it clear that both Rwanda and Congo have used rebel movements as sort of proxies in their long COVID struggle. It is so far the most detailed report on such allegations. There are two main points in it. First, the report shows the direct links between the Rwandan authorities and Congolese rebels led by Laurent Kunda, with a research based on dozens of interviews, bank records, phone records. It says that the Rwandan army has been directly involved in the supply of military equipment, in the recruitment of combatants, including child soldiers, and that the rebels were in direct contact with Rwandan officials, and that bank accounts used by the rebels to finance their operation are actually based in Rwanda. Now, the second strong part is that it shows how the Congolese army has been collaborating with the Rwandan Hutu militia, which poured into eastern Congo after the Rwandan genocide in 1994. In fact, some of these militias leaders were involved in the genocide. Now, these militia are the ones Laurent Kunda says is fighting, as he says is protecting minorities in the region, particularly the ethnic Tutsis, from these external forces. So the report says that Congolese troops have been providing the Rwandan Hutu rebels with ammunition and weapons in return for their assistance.
And what are the implications, then, of this very strongly, from what you describe, worded report that hasn't even been released yet? I mean, you actually got your hands on an early copy of it, right?
Yes, exactly. This is a draft report. The final report was presented on Wednesday afternoon, so yesterday, to the Sanctions Committee of the United Nations Security Council. It should become public in the next few days. It could also be released next week. Now, this report could have a real impact on what's going on in the eastern region of North Kivu. The major impact that it could have is obviously on the international community, as you know, Western governments can now decide whether or not they want to shift, for example, their aid, like the US or Great Britain, which are strong support, for example, to the Rwandan authorities.
And it could potentially mark a shift. Thomas Fessy, thanks for your report. That was BBC correspondent Thomas Fessy coming to us from Kinshasa, the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 11th, and time for some headlines.
And the time is 27 minutes to the top of the hour. No good news for the job market. New unemployment numbers hit their highest level in 26 years. The figures were much worse than analysts were expecting. Belgian police have arrested 14 people they think are linked with Al-Qaeda. Prosecutors say one of them might have been planning a suicide attack. The suspects had recently travelled to Pakistan and Afghanistan. California is set to adopt what would be the nation's most sweeping global warming plan. Regulators are ready to put into action that new plan today. It includes tough rules for industry for cutting greenhouse emissions, and the state's goal is to roll back emissions to 1990 levels in about a decade. The Golden Globe nominations came out this morning. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Frost slash Nixon, and Doubt led the pack with 5 nominations each. Now, among the supporting acting nominees, the late Heath Ledger for his role as Joker in The Dark Knight. And Best Original Song nominees were very animated, including this number. And that's the start of the theme from WALL-E, about a little robot who takes out the trash. Bolt was also nominated for Best Song. And the 66th Golden Globes, are on January the 11th, the actual awards ceremony.
And it's not just movies. Tina Fey is going to clean up.
Movies and TV as well.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
So we're talking about concert memories today. Think back.
My first concert was the Partridge Family at Madison Square Garden, way up in the rafters. And I got to say, I'm going to call my mom today and thank her for going through that for me. I think I love you.
Hey, folks, Cassidy still plays Vegas. What's your favorite concert memory? What'd you go to see? What was it like? And how has your taste changed? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
And some of you out there might be thanking us here at The Takeaway after you listen to our next guest. We're just weeks away from Hanukkah, Christmas, and the New Year, and of course a time when many are thinking about their travel plans, with many anticipating that given the economic troubles, fewer will be taking to the sky, railways, or the roads. But there may be some better deals out there than you think. Joining us with those is George Hobica, founder of AirfareWatchdog.com. Welcome back, George.
Good morning.
Surprisingly, there are some air deals out there.
Yeah, I was looking today online just a few minutes ago, and your listeners can actually hop on these Philadelphia to Orlando. These are all peak Christmas week travel dates, like leaving on the 23rd, coming back on the Sunday after Christmas with tax. Philadelphia to Orlando, $185 round trip.
That's pretty good.
Wow.
Come back on Saturday, it's $145 round trip. L.A., New York to L.A., 391 nonstop flights, American Airlines, same deal with tax, leaving Tuesday or Monday before Christmas, coming back on the Saturday or Sunday after Christmas. That's an amazing deal. And everyone said that these fares were going to – and they were. It was $900 because I have a friend who booked this for like $800 3 months ago. And he said,
New York to L.A. flight.
Yeah. Yeah.
$800.
Yeah, and that looked good at the time because another airline was charging $1,000. And then it went down, and then it went up, and then it went down, and now it's down again. So if people were discouraged 3 months ago, thinking, "Oh, I can't afford to go home for Christmas or travel over New Year's," they should think again, because the economy has deteriorated faster than the seat reductions on the airlines.
And something you point out that I have never heard of, and I've been flying for 20 years, I have never heard what is offered by United, Alaska, and Southwest, which is if your fare drops between the time that you buy the ticket and you get on the plane, they'll give you the difference?
They give you the difference back in the form of a voucher. Now, all airlines, most airlines do this, but they are going to deduct a fee up to $150, sometimes $200, from what they return to you. United doesn't do this. Southwest and Alaska don't do this. They give you the entire amount back when there's a fare drop in the form of a voucher. You have to stay on the same flight, same dates. You can't change that, but as long as you do that, you get your money back.
Which brings us to another point that you make, which is be careful of the hidden fees.
Right. You know, it's not the price anymore of the fare that really counts so much. It's the fees. If you have heavy bags, if you have a pet in the cabin, a pet in a cabin on United now costs $350 round trip.
Wow.
I know. So, Fido's staying home this Christmas.
But there are other kinds of fees, right? I mean, that's not surprising. For those of us who are pet owners, we already know we have to buy a ticket for our pet, regardless of whether they're in cargo or they're actually in the cabin with you. But you're saying that there are really other fees that we need to be looking for.
Yeah, there are all kinds of fees now. Some of them are legitimate, like cashing in a frequent flyer ticket. Like, I just cashed in a frequent flyer ticket, supposedly free, to go to L.A. for Christmas, and they charged me $80 on Delta because supposedly I did it last minute. Well, they say last minute is 21 days or fewer. You know, unaccompanied minor fees have gone up. The fees have gone up. I think that's the key. I mean, they always charge for pets, but it wasn't $350. It used to be
$100. It used to be about $80 each way,
right,
depending on where you're going.
So they charge for people with, like, bad hair?
they should charge for people who are rude, you know.
Right. Yeah,
but
okay.
As for the frequent flyer, though, that's always sort of existed. And we just recently went to Africa and went using frequent flyer miles, and it was still an eighth or a sixteenth of the cost it would have been to actually buy a ticket.
Yeah, they're still a good deal, especially for first class and upgrades. But now,
business class.
Starting next year, United is going to start charging additional fees for upgrading to business class. So they're adding fees on top of fees. If you have heavy bags too, it's a really good idea to take it, 50 pounds or over. If you have two or more bags, take them to the post office. Wrap them up in priority mail tape. You don't even have to get a box. And ship them. You'll find that it's probably less expensive than paying the overweight and oversized.
But then you also have to account for the time it takes you to make that trip.
Right. Well, I live right next to the post office, so maybe I'm prejudiced.
So in other words, the big takeaway, though, here, George, is for those who were thinking that air travel really might be extravagantly expensive this holiday season, turns out it may not be so.
On certain routes, on certain dates, use a flexible date search, too. Go to Travelocity Orbitz, and they have little boxes where you can check flexible dates, and if you adjust your travel by maybe one day, you can save a lot of money.
And where are you going for the holidays?
I'm going to L.A. on a frequent flyer ticket. I upgraded to business class on Delta because I just can't stand those little thin seats anymore at my age.
At your age. Well, let me ask you this. You ever been to a concert?
I have been, yes.
And what was your first concert?
It was James Taylor. I'll date myself.
Oh, you're such a softie.
I know, right?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Was it a good one?
It was great, yeah.
Did he play Fire and Rain?
Of course.
Of course.
Yeah. And right. my last one, I don't go to concerts that often, was Bob Dylan at Madison Square Garden.
And how was that one?
It was great. I really liked it because there were so many different ages there. It was amazing, like really like teenagers and grandparents.
You know, that was the case with the Police. I saw the Police on their latest tour, their sort of last tour, and there were all kinds of, geriatrics.
I know.
And young kids. And it was amazing, and everybody was completely rocking on it, and it was a fantastic concert, by the way.
Yeah. Intergenerational. I guess the kids listen to, the grandparents' albums.
I bet you Sting would like to think he's a little bit more relevant than that. But thanks very much, George Hobica. George Hobica is the creator of AirfareWatch.com.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and it's trivia time. Can you name any of the 85 critics and reporters in the Hollywood Foreign Press Association? Of course you can't. But the Press Association's sponsorship of the Golden Globe Awards, I'm sure you know that. It's one of the biggest award shows anywhere, and its nominations for movies and television is one of the big precursors to the Oscar hunt. Joining us to talk about the Golden Globe nominations, which came out within the hour, is Sharon Waxman, Takeaway contributor and editor-in-chief of The Wrap News, the best place online to get your information about the entertainment business. Sharon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, the headline seems to be Dark Knight. Heath Ledger got a nomination, and the movie was very well received, and also Brad Pitt gets a nomination here. Take us away through these nominations and what they mean.
Well, the nominations were not those guys didn't get Best Picture, so Brad Pitt's movie did, but a lot of people were looking for Dark Knight to be nominated for Best Picture, which would have been a saving grace for Hollywood because here's a movie people have heard of. People even went to see it, but it was not nominated for Best Picture. But yes, Heath Ledger was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, who, of course, died right after filming of that movie. But what we've got are a lot of small movies this year being nominated for Best Picture. picture. You've got Frost Nixon, which is about, it's kind of like a chamber piece that was a play about David Frost interviewing Richard Nixon. Benjamin Button's is supposed to be a big movie. That's the only one on the list, though. A movie called The Reader, Revolutionary Road, Slumdog Millionaire is this very sweet but very indie film about two Indian kids in a slum, and a small indie film called The Visitor. So what this means is that, you know, the Golden Globes and the Academy Awards count on the big films to bring the audience, to bring celebrities, and they've been struggling against the fact that there have not been enough good movies that have been big commercial hits in the past number of years, and that's going to be a problem again this year.
So in terms of driving audience, maybe it's sobering, but, you know, some of these movies are challenging, complicated, interesting, dramatic subjects.
Absolutely. But what was left off the list for Best Picture is a film that a lot of people are talking about. Is this film called Milk, in which Sean Penn plays Harvey Milk, a San Francisco gay politician who was murdered, and that's getting lots of great reviews. It was not nominated. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard. Usually people look to the Golden Globes to get a sense of what's going to be nominated for the Oscars. This year I have the feeling that it's going to be all over the map again.
All over the map.
And of course, last year the Golden Globes were canceled, so they were no harm.
That's right, because of the strike.
So, and we may have one of those again.
Let's quickly look at television, because often the Golden Globes do predict accurately trends in television, drama, and comedy.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so we've got nominations for House, and we've got nominations for Mad Men, and these are series that are very popular and that have already been pretty much showered with glory at the Emmys. So,
but once again, it's the networks versus the cable outlets. It's HBO versus broadcast.
Yep, and this is and the cable stations are winning. So you've got Gabriel Byrne from In Treatment was nominated. That's another HBO show. Michael C. Hall from Dexter, and it's the Showtime show. So the networks are struggling against the cable networks, I'd say, for sure.
All right, well, to get more on this, you can sign up for Sharon Waxman's daily email at therapnews.com. But trends considering, movies all over the map, and the awardees in television are the usual suspects. Sharon Waxman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 11th, and Femi Oke has joined us with the latest headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. A suicide bomber has struck a crowded restaurant in Kirkuk, Iraq, leaving during the last day of the Muslim holiday Eid, and police say that almost 50 people were killed and around 100 wounded. Former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle is set to play a key role in the Obama administration's health care efforts. The president-elect is scheduled to nominate Daschle as health secretary this morning. And Daschle is also expected to run a new White House Office of Health Reform. In Afghanistan, Defense Secretary Robert Gates brought promises of reinforcements there. American commanders want 20,000 new troops, and they will get them. Gates says that he could have most of those in place by the summer. And Gates will continue as defense secretary in the Obama administration. In sports, Tim Tebow has been nominated for his second straight Heisman Trophy. He'll go up against Oklahoma's Sam Bradford and Colt McCoy from Texas for college football's largest prize. And it's the first time that all three Heisman finalists are quarterbacks since 2001. And the award will be handed out on Saturday night. And the Golden Globe nominations are out this morning. Now, among the supporting acting nominations is one for the late Heath Ledger for his role in The Dark Knight.
You complete me. You're garbage. You kills for money.
Don't talk like one of them. You're not. Even if you'd like to be.
That's the late Heath Ledger for his role in The Joker, Dark Knight. And the Golden Globes will be out January the 11th. Adora John.
Thanks very much, Femi. We're going to move on to talk about population. Some 6 billion people inhabit planet Earth, and by 2050, that number is expected to jump to 9 billion, and that's a conservative estimate, at least according to some. Here to help us write yet another chapter for America's briefing book is researcher Joel Cohen, a professor of populations at Rockefeller and Columbia Universities. He sits on the board of trustees for the Population Research Bureau. Joel, thanks for being with us. For you, overpopulation is a dirty word, right?
It's a cover for a lot of complex problems that include population, economics, the environment, and culture. And to put all of the problems on population alone confuses the issue and isn't really helpful.
And you mentioned many issues. Clearly, when you're talking about populations, you're talking about resources, you're talking about competition for resources.
Right.
You're talking to President-elect Barack Obama. And where do you tell him to start when he's thinking about these issues?
I think he should start with the well-being and needs of individuals, women, men, and children in families around the world. He should start by trying to enable every woman to be in command of her own fertility. That means reproductive health services and contraception. It means trying to assure that every child that's born is born to parents who want that child at that time and have the means and ability to take care of that child.
How much of the population do you think is represented by births that aren't a result of women in control of their fertility or parents who don't want the children that come into the world?
According to surveys in the United States, more than half of conceptions are either mistimed or not wanted at any time.
Whoa.
Something like 57%.
That sounds enormous.
In fact, it is enormous. And remember that one-third of births in the United States are out of wedlock. In other countries, the fraction out of wedlock is much higher, but it's much more culturally accepted than it is here. Worldwide, the fraction of births that are either mistimed or not wanted at any time is substantial, and it could be somewhere between a third and a half.
And you've argued that education is critical, both here in the United States and all over the world, for a number of reasons, not only for women being in control of their fertility, but for other reasons, like postponing thinking about having babies, period.
Well, I think education is the great enabling force. What the Colt 45 was to the Wild West, education is now. It's the great equalizer, and it not only enables women to be more effective in caring for themselves, it improves the survival of their offspring, very dramatic improvements in child survival. It delays the onset of childbearing, typically delays the onset of marriage in most cultures. And it gives you people who are capable of solving the problems that we can't even foresee that will be coming along later on in this century.
Although in a world where 2 billion people don't have access to clean water and
yes.
Maybe a billion are surviving on an income of $1 a day or less, there are some scaling issues here, particularly involving policy like education, that are real, real challenges. I'm wondering if we can calculate what the planet will bear. If 6 billion is at the level that we're at right now, can we go to 12 billion? Can we go to 15 billion without some radical rethinking of lifestyles and inequalities?
That's a very difficult question. We're at 6.7 billion right now. We are growing enough food to feed 10 billion people, but we feed 40% of all the cereal grains that we grow to domestic animals, chicken, cattle, pigs. And so even though we're growing 10 billion people's worth of food, we have 800 million to a billion people who are chronically hungry every day. So I don't know the answer to your question about how many people can the Earth support, because the answer depends on a whole bunch of other questions. at what average level of income do we want people to live, and what distribution of income? Are we going to be happy with a lot of hungry people and a few people living high off the hog, so to speak? Are we going to be happy with an environment that has parking lots or parks? Do we want jaguars with four wheels or four legs? What kind of a world do we want? And those value choices depend not on my choices, but my children's and your children's and their children's choices. So it's not really clear whether the world can or cannot support $12 billion, but I can tell you we're doing a pretty crummy job taking care of the $6.7 billion we've got right now, and we ought to be focusing more of our attention on the problems we're facing today.
And based on your research, if you were to give Barack Obama two pieces of advice, one on how he would address those issues in the United States, and two, how he would address them internationally?
Another good question. My first choice would be to emphasize education as a liberating force. We've adopted the goal of universal primary education, and we're most of the way there except in sub-Saharan Africa, where it's about 85% access. I think the world should adopt and can afford universal secondary education so that all boys and girls get 10 to 12 years of really high-quality education. That includes education about their own bodies, their own societies, mm-hmm. their own cultures and language, so they can place themselves in the larger context of human culture.
And what about here in the U.S. specifically?
I think we're doing an inadequate job of educating our own people. The rank of the United States in competitive examinations that are internationally comparable is low. We are down there with a number of the less developed rich countries. And it's an embarrassment. And especially when you look at our coming competition from China, Korea,
and
Japan,
India, and
India, they're taking seriously the science and technology education of their students.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the same high expectations, and we don't get the same high results.
Make education a priority. That's the message for President-elect Barack Obama from Joel Cohen, professor of populations at Rockefeller and Columbia Universities. Thanks, Joel.
So maybe a billion people didn't show up, but what was your first concert?
My first concert was Janis Joplin in the Fillmore East.
My very first concert was Gloria Estefan and Miami Sound Machine, 1979, in Miami Beach, Florida.
Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer. Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer.
Nice try, guys, but we still couldn't get out of the 70s this morning. Who did you go see? What was it like? Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
Anybody who has a relationship with Governor Blagojevich right now is radioactive. You don't want that.
That's Amanda Vinicky, State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio, talking about the governor there who is in the midst of an unfolding scandal.
Radioactive. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.